I know that I've talked about this in the past. My favorite definition of faith comes from Hebrews 11, verse 6. And what I like to do with that text is take out the two negatives. There's a double negative in the sentence. And when you take out the double negative, the sentence says, "And with faith it is possible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him." And in that text, we find three very important keys to faith, three very important definitions or definitive terms that give us the true idea of what faith is. The first one is the idea of being convinced. Looking at the text there, believe that he is. So we must be convinced that God exists. If we're going to please him, in order to have faith, we have to first begin with the idea of being convinced that God does exist. But if that's as far as we get, then we're no better than the demons. The demons believe and tremble because they don't have faith. They know God exists, but they don't believe in him. They don't have faith in him. They don't trust him, and they certainly don't obey him. So the second part of this definition in this sentence is the idea of being convicted of our sin, convicted of our need to bow before God. And you wonder, well, where does that come from? Well, it comes from in that statement there that he is a rewarder. When you talk about the idea of reward, it's the idea of payment for work well done, or its opposite, punishment for failure to do it right. And so this tells us or reminds us that we need to understand that God exists and that he is a rewarder or punisher of those who would follow him. If we're going to believe in him, he's going to reward us for our faith, or he is going to punish us for our lack of faith. So both of these, being convinced and convicted, are an important part of faith. But there's a third part. There's a third level that we need to take it to, and that is the idea of being compliant. We have to be compliant with God's will. Notice again what the sentence says. A rewarder of those who seek him. And contained within this idea of the word seek is the idea of diligent desire and intensive pursuit. It's not the idea of, well, you know, I'd like to find God and I'll look for God. It's the idea of I have to have God. It's the idea of you've lost your keys, your car keys, and you're looking for your car keys because you have to be somewhere 10 minutes ago. You're trying to get to Lexington because the grandchild's being born. And you've got to get there now because of all of the things involved in that. And you have to find those car keys. You don't wander around. Well, I wonder where they are. You are moving stuff. You're looking for your keys. And this is the idea here that he's talking about as far as our seeking God. We are moving heaven and earth to find him and to comply with his will. Seeking God has to be infinitely or exponentially more intense even than searching for keys in that kind of situation, because it is the ultimate issue of life. Standing before God, having faith in God, is the ultimate issue in life. And if we drop any one of those three, we don't have faith. And we become like King Saul that we've been talking about for the past couple of weeks. And now we're finishing up tonight with King Saul. As we look at his status as a paragon of faith, hall of shame, because of the shame of unbelief. He did not believe in God. He believed that God existed. We'll give him that, and I think it's clear that he did. But he had no real conviction of his own sin, and he was not going to be compliant with God's will. And so tonight, what we're going to do is we're going to look at the last stage of Saul's life, what we're going to call a descent into madness. Saul is really just plunging off a cliff into insanity, irrationality. His faith never seems to rise above being convinced that God exists. He never seemed to be convinced of his personal sin. Even when confronted by Samuel in chapter 13 and in chapter 15, he just never seemed to get it that he did anything wrong. He was the king after all, so he was in charge, so his will was all that mattered. And it especially we saw at the end of class or sermon last week, or last Sunday night, when we looked at how he assaulted God's spokesman. He laid his hand on Samuel and snatched him so hard that it tore his robe. And that's when Samuel said, "Just like you tore my robe, your kingdom will be torn away from you." And Saul occasionally would be in going in the same direction God went. His interests would be aligned with God's interests. And we need to make sure that we understand that just because my interest is aligned with God's interests and we're going in the same direction, that is not compliance with the will of God. That is coincidental interest in the same things. Because what that means is that the moment God's interest goes in a different direction, I'm still going to go the way I want to go. God can go this way. I'm going this way. So I've never complied with God's will. It was coincidental going along with and are in the same direction. That's where Saul was. And as we're going to see really kind of at the end, and there's really no takeaway at the end of this series or at the end of this sermon except that unbelief always leads to madness. Well, you look around at the world today and you look at what's going on in our country today and you wonder, how is this happening? How is this insanity, this madness just consuming our world? Unbelief is the answer. Unbelief, just like Saul. And so what we're going to do tonight as we look at Saul's descent into madness, we're going to add a fourth C to this group of C's. We have convinced, convicted, and compliant. We're going to add clueless. Because Saul was clueless. And we see his cluelessness in three ways. Clueless jealousy of David, a clueless pursuit of David, God's chosen replacement, and a clueless search for truth in the wrong places. Let's begin with the clueless journey, the clueless jealousy of David. And it really kind of begins in chapter 17. We're not going to look at, well, let's look at chapter 17 briefly. In chapter 17, we are introduced to Saul and David together in the battle against the Philistines and the battle against Goliath. And what we find is that Saul is a cowardly king. He's hiding in his tent. When David has to come and rescue the people of God from this enemy because of his faith in God. And we wonder, why are you saying Saul was hiding in his tent? Look at verse 11, 1 Samuel 17, verse 11. When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Saul was head and shoulders taller than all the Israelites. Why didn't he go out in the name of God and defend and attack this Philistine dog like David did? He didn't trust God. He didn't have any faith in God. He was afraid. He was a coward hiding in his tent. And so then this created an opportunity for jealousy to begin. And there's no indication here in chapter 17 of any real jealousy toward David. But it began very quickly in chapter 18. In chapter 18, when David is set aside to begin serving Saul and working for Saul and leading men and going out and fighting against the Philistines on Saul's behalf. We all know the story, right? Do you know the story? We know the story, right? Look at verse 5 of chapter 18. So David went out wherever Saul sent him and prospered. And Saul set him over the men of war. And it was pleasing in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. Notice who's left out of the being pleased section here. The people were happy. Saul's servants were happy. But Saul's already starting to, I think, become a little jealous. Verse 6. It happened as they were coming, when David returned from killing the Philistine, that the women came out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy, and with musical instruments. So they're coming out. Saul is leading the army, and people are coming out, and they're singing, and they're dancing, and they're happy, and they're excited. And here's what they sing. Verse 7. The women sang as they played, and said, "Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. Uh-oh. Now we have an opportunity for jealousy. In fact, verse 8. Then Saul became very angry, for this saying displeased him. And he said, They have ascribed to David 10,000s, but to me they have ascribed to thousands. But what more now? What more can he have but the kingdom? And so David is just growing and growing in acclaim with the people. And so his fame is just spreading throughout the nation. And Saul is coming up short, even though he's much taller in comparison. And from that moment on, he begins his descent into madness. Because this song had to bring to mind what Samuel had told him back in chapter 13 and chapter 15. Remember chapter 13, verses 13 and 14? God has sought out a man after his own heart to become king after you. And then in chapter 15, he said God has torn this kingdom from you and given it to a better man. And so that's why he says, what more can he have but the kingdom? Now, there's no indication that Saul actually knew that David had been anointed to be king in his place. If so, he might have made greater effort to kill him. But he's thinking that this is the man that Samuel was talking about, even if it had not been revealed to him at the time. And notice verse 9. Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day on. So he was sitting there thinking that this guy's out to get me. He is, in his mind, David is out to get Saul. And as we see, as we work our way through this, we see over and over again that David never is out to get Saul. David was a supporter of Saul. He would have served Saul until Saul's natural death and then stepped in as king, except Saul would not have that. Saul was not willing to do it that way. And so he began his descent into madness. And it was a rapid descent. Notice chapter 9, in verse 10 of chapter 18. The very next day. Now it came about on the next day that an evil spirit from God came mightily upon Saul, and he raved in the midst of the house while David was playing the harp with his hand as usual. And so this goes back to chapter 16, where David had been brought as a musician to sing for Saul. And so he was singing for Saul and trying to keep Saul's mind at peace because of his frustration with his and his disobedience to God. Verse 11, Saul hurled the spear. A spear was in Saul's hand. Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, I will pin David to the wall. But David escaped from his presence twice. Think about this. He tried to kill him, and David got out and away. And then he came back, thinking that Saul's just lost his mind. And in a sense he had, but he did it twice. He tried to kill him twice. And oddly enough, he continued to stick around, because in verse 13, Saul removed him from his presence and appointed him as commander of his people. And he went out and came out and went out before the people. And so he had murderous intent against David. But keeping David around and thinking maybe the Philistines would kill him in war was a mistake, because in verse 14, David was prospering in all his ways, for the Lord was with him. When Saul saw that he was prospering greatly, he dreaded him. Instead of being happy and excited and joyful that he had a man that would serve him faithfully and serve the nation and that God was honoring, he hated it. He hated this fact, and he hated the man. And so he had this clueless jealousy. He didn't realize what a benefit to his kingdom David would have been and could have been. And so he tries to kill him, and then David sticks around. Later, in chapter 18, there when Saul found out that David loved his daughter, he thought of the plan to get David killed. And remember this? This was where he'd go out and bring me the foreskin of 100 Philistines, and you can have my daughter as your wife. So David said, okay, that's fine with me. They're God's enemies. I'll go out and kill them all day long. Comes in with 200 instead of 100. And counts them in, and he's given that Micah as his wife, Saul's daughter. But nothing, no matter what Saul tried, it didn't work. Go down to chapter 18, verses 28 through 30. We're there in chapter 18, verses 28 through 30. When Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David and that Michal, David's daughter, loved him, or Saul's daughter, loved him, then Saul was even more afraid of David. Thus, Saul was David's enemy continually. Then the commanders of the Philistines went out to battle, and it happened as often as they went out that David behaved himself more wisely than all the servants of Saul, so his name was highly esteemed. And so Saul is just clueless here. He has no idea of what to do or how to deal with David, except because of his disbelief in God, his unfaithfulness with God, he had to do something drastic about it. He saw him as a threat when David was never a threat. He was convinced that God is, but Saul was never convicted of his sin and never compliant with God's will. And so we get to the next thing, the clueless pursuit, because Saul issued a standing order. Saul had tried to kill him. Saul tried to get the enemies to kill him. And so finally now in chapter 19, verse 1, Saul told Jonathan, his son, and all his servants to put David to death. So now we got a standing order. Kill David. And this leads to a clueless pursuit. Until now, David had been able to hang out and be with the people of Israel and around the army and around Saul, and around Jonathan. But now David has to spend a decade or more actually fleeing for his life, hiding from Saul, because Saul now is going to pursue him and have his soldiers pursue him at every possible opportunity to try to put him to death. And it was a foolish, clueless pursuit. God was prospering David, and Saul foolishly thought that he could kill this man that God was favoring and honoring. When we think about it, kind of as a side point, when we think that we can get away with sin and that God won't notice and God won't care when we don't do his will, are we any less foolish than Saul? Don't think so. And so then beginning in chapter 20, or actually there in chapter 19 and going down through chapter 28, you have this constant back and forth between Saul, what I call the seesaw spirit of Saul. Saul chases David for a while, and then the Philistines rise up and he has to step away from that, or he chases him for a while, and all of a sudden David has him in a position where he could have killed Saul but refused to do that, and Saul relents and accepts the fact that he had messed up and admits that he had messed up and steps back. And then a little while later, he comes back. Remember last time we talked about climbing out on that limb just before it crashes to the ground? Saul keeps climbing back out on that limb to crash down to the ground and pursuing David. Instead of focusing on his primary duty, being king of God's people, the nation of Israel, his focus was on chasing one person and trying to kill one person. The one person who would have made his reign a success. Instead of serving God and protecting the nation, he pursued David. And at first, it's interesting there in chapter 19 that Jonathan, his son, is able to talk him down. Verse 4 of 1 Samuel 19, then Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said to him, "Do not let the king sin against his servant David, since he has not sinned against you, and since his deeds have been very beneficial to you." So think, Dad, David hasn't done anything to you, and everything David does is good for you. Verse 5, for he took his life in his hand and struck the Philistine, and the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by putting David to death without a cause? And Saul listened. He just up back and forth. It says, Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan, and Saul vowed, "As the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death." Now, how long did that last? Not very long. Later on, he tried to kill him again. In verse 10, Saul tried to pin David to the wall with a spear, but he slipped away out of Saul's presence, so that he stuck the spear into the wall, and David fled and escaped that night. Now, how many of us are going to hang around a guy who's always trying to throw spears at us? Whether they're literal, physical ones, or verbal ones. Around people that are mean to you, you don't want to be around those kind of people very long. And certainly David continues, and so now he's no longer able to be around him. A couple of times later, In chapter 22, Saul actually orders the murder of the priests of God because they helped David. And just a cowardly explosion of violence and hatred that is just unbelievably callous and so sinful. But then later, Saul catches David or has him almost trapped. And in chapter 24, in verses 17 through 22, in one of those occasions, Saul is in a cave and David cuts off a piece of his cloth and then lets him go. And notice what he says in verses 17 through 22 when he's told, David had you, I had you, I could have killed you. Verse 17, he said to David, you are more righteous than I, for you have dealt well with me, while I have dealt wickedly with you. So a moment of clarity and sanity. You have declared today that you have done good to me, that the Lord delivered me into your hand, and yet you did not kill me. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him go away safely? May the Lord therefore reward you with good in return for what you have done to me this day. Another side issue is this kind of is the pattern that God tries to show for us, that you treat your enemies with love instead of hatred. Verse 20, now behold, I know that you will surely be king and that the kingdom of Israel will be established in your hands. So whether he ever was told David was anointed by Samuel to replace you, he knows that's who's going to replace him by now, that it's going to be David. Verse 21, so now swear to me by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants after me and that you will not destroy my name from my father's household. David swore to Saul. Saul went to his home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold. So they kept apart and had a little bit of peace, but it didn't last very long. In chapter 26, he starts chasing him again. In chapter 26, and again, David spares his life when he could have killed him. And notice in verse 21 of 1 Samuel 26, then Saul said, I have sinned. You see a pattern here over and over again. He claims that he knows he sinned, but then he comes right back to doing it again. Return, my son David, for I will not harm you again because my life was precious in your sight this day. Behold, I have played the fool and have committed a serious error. The only thing it seemed like he really regretted is that he failed and got embarrassed and ashamed of what he had tried to do and the fact that he had not succeeded. Verse 25, then Saul said to David, blessed are you, my son David. You will both accomplish much and surely prevail. So David went on his way, and Saul returned to his place. But as the text continues, David still had to hide from Saul. Actually had to go in amongst the Philistines. And this leads up to the last thing that we want to talk about, is that his madness keeps going so deep and so much further into the ground that now we see him in a clueless search when he talks to the witch of Endor in chapter 28. In chapter 28, he actually talks to a witch who then brings up Samuel to talk to him. And it's a very strange account because Saul had actually, in one instance, had actually done what God wanted him to do. Now, whether it was because he was trying to please God out of obedience, or just simply having a feeling like, well, this is convenient. Again, that concurrent or coincidental compliance that was not real heart compliance. Verse 3. Now Samuel was dead, and all Israel had lamented him and buried him in Ramah, his own city. And Saul had removed from the land those who were mediums and spiritists. And so he had gotten rid of them. Now he's trying to find something out. And when we talk about a clueless search, what Saul now is trying to find and searching for is a message from God that's different from the message from God that he had received through Samuel already. He was trying to find somebody who would come and tell him God didn't mean what he said. And again, kind of a side note, this is the problem for any of us when we don't want to do what God says and we start looking for preachers and teachers and other people who will tell us that we don't have to do what the Bible says. We don't have to do what God says. We're like Saul in that respect. Whenever we find a sin that we're involved in that we don't want to stop, And we find a preacher or a teacher who will say, God's okay with that. We're like Saul. We're searching for somebody to contradict God. Because he's convinced that God didn't really mean it when he said he was going to tear the kingdom away from him and give it to a better man. So he calls up this witch from Endor, and she calls up Samuel. And notice, and this is she was as shocked as he was, or as they were, when he actually showed up. But when Samuel spoke to them, notice what he said in verses 8, 15 through 19. Then Samuel said to Saul, and I'll give you the Cliff Notes version, and then we'll read the text. Samuel said, nothing's changed. God's word hasn't changed. Verse 15, why have you disturbed me by bringing me up? And Saul answered, I am greatly distressed, for the Philistines are waging war against me, and God has departed from me and no longer answers me, either through prophets or by dreams. Therefore I have called you, that you may make known to me what I should do. Samuel said, why then do you ask me, since the Lord has departed from you and has become your adversary? There's a reason you're not hearing from God, because you don't believe in him. 17, the Lord has done accordingly as he spoke through me. So I will give you a message, Saul. It's the same one that I gave you before. As he spoke through me, for the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your neighbor David. All right, so I told you he's going to give it to a better man, that the man after his own heart. He's going to give it. That man is David. Well, you know that by now. Nothing's changed. The message is the same. As you did not obey the Lord and did not execute his fierce wrath on Amalek, so the Lord has done the same to you this day. Moreover, the Lord will also give over Israel along with you into the hands of the Philistines. Therefore, tomorrow you and your sons will be with me. Indeed, the Lord will give over the army of Israel into the hands of the Philistines. A clueless search is an effort to find a different message. When we try to find messages from God that are different from what God says, whatever we may think gives us that message, if it tells us in our mind that we don't have to do what God says, it's not from God. It's from ourselves, from some false teacher trying to tell us what they think we want to hear. God speaks and has spoken to us in his word. And it's the same today as it was 2,000 years ago. And we need to listen to it instead of cluelessly searching for something different. And despite all that he had heard and all that he knew, Saul still didn't believe and sort of fell out in dismay because he just couldn't believe that this was going to happen. Verse 20, then Saul immediately fell full length upon the ground and was very afraid because of the words of Samuel. He should have known it already. He had been told it over and over again. For decades he had heard this message and he still did not have faith in God. So, clueless jealousy, clueless pursuit, and clueless search. Go ahead and get your songbooks out. We're just going to wrap up here with final thoughts about King Saul and the shame of disbelief. You know, for a reign that started with such great hope and promise, it ended with despair and disgrace. It ended in the shame of unbelief. In a life of faith that begins, oftentimes a life of faith will begin with great hope and great promise, but it will end in shame and disgrace when unbelief takes over and keeps us from serving God the way we should. You know, I wonder why did God choose Saul? I don't know. I really don't. The text doesn't say. Maybe it was because he was a king after their own heart. He was the kind of king they wanted. And they found out that the kind of king they wanted is not one that's good for them. And it serves as an object lesson for us that the kind of life that chooses to do our own will instead of God's will always ends in shame and disgrace. And so we must not pursue that. And the good thing is that we know David was finally ready to step up and step into Saul's shoes and take over the nation. But that's a different study. We're going to actually talk about David. Have some sermons on him beginning next month. The real question for each of us as we think about the invitation we're going to sing in just a moment is, what are we doing? Will we reject Saul's shame and choose to have a heart like David? Unbelief is summed up in one word, clueless. Will we get a clue from God's message through Saul and have faith like David? That's the offer God makes to each one of us. And that's the plea that God makes with each one of us. Trust me. That's what he says to every one of us. Trust. When I say this, trust me that I mean it. Because if we can't trust him to mean it when he says, repent and be baptized for the remission of sins, how can we trust him when he says, I will forgive you of your sins? Because that's unbelief. If we don't believe him in one thing, why would we believe him in anything? But he offers salvation and forgiveness. He offers us, if we will have hope and faith and faithfully obey him, be compliant with his will, he'll forgive us of our sin. He'll accept us and he'll lift us up and raise us to glory with him and with his son in eternity. If you need to be right with God in any way, we beg you, please come. Come right now while we stand and while we sing.